America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and welcome back to America Trends. So are you one of those skeptics who doesn't believe the government can solve our problems any longer? And that has led, of course, to a lot of division and rancor and polarization. But at least in our midst, there is a president now who does believe that he needs to go big and thinks he can, and that's how he can bring the country together. Now, before he took office, Mitchell Weiss, a Harvard Business School professor, was shouting from the rooftops that he believes that government can be entrepreneurial. He thinks government can imagine. Government can try new things and test and be experimental and can get out of its own bureaucratic way. He's got lessons that he unfolds in his new book, We the Possibility. And we're going to be talking to him about that and find out if we can catch some of the enthusiasm that he has for what the public sector can actually achieve. That's all today on America Trends.
Welcome back to America Trends, and I have on the line with me Mitchell Weiss. He is a professor of management practice in the Entrepreneurial Management Unit and a faculty member at Harvard Business School. And I think that's important to say because, Mitchell, you have a concept in your book, We the Possibility, that we need to look at government just as we do in the private sector. With all of the startups that we've seen, all the entrepreneurship that has been so much talked about in the recent period as it relates to technology, that we need to start thinking that way as it relates to government. And yet we're so far from that now. I did another podcast recently where the author and in the foreword to the book, his writer said that this is the greatest collapse of American society in so short a time ever as it relates to the way we in the public sector have responded to the pandemic.
Certainly, we've seen a lot of problems pile up. This is the most gigantic one, and we're not yet through it. I think it's unfortunately not the only problem we've seen pile up. And so, yes, I think that people have been losing faith in government because they haven't seen problems getting solved. And we have solving them. I think it will take in part adapting what we know about entrepreneurship, not wholesale. I certainly wouldn't suggest that we take, Larry, everything we know about entrepreneurship in the private sector and foist it on the public sector, especially because we've seen failures in the private sector as well. Right? But I do think we need to be more inventive in the public sector so that we can solve public problems anymore and so that we can restore faith.
But what comes first, Mitchell? Is it the trust? I mean, or does the public have to see that, wow, things are really getting done? You know, the old notion of cranes in the air. I mean, is there some need to see something before the public begins to sign back on and say, yes, I have confidence in what it is that's being done in my name and representing my interests?
Well, I think it's a great question. I think they go hand in hand, the seeing and the trust and the seeing. It's one of the reasons why in the book I advocate for government to get to problem solving quicker, because the public is rightfully impatient to see some progress. So I do think that being more entrepreneurial in government will allow people to show the public solutions more swiftly. But I also think that we can't wait to just show. We also have to restore trust by telling. And what we need to tell the public is we're going to try new things. Not all of them are going to work. When we try them, we promise you we're not going to waste too much time. We're not going to waste too much treasure. But you're going to see some failures along the way. modest ones. We promise to learn from them. If we only do and don't tell, when we make those mistakes, then we're going to get punished in the public sector even more for them than we already are. And so we're going to need to do both, I think, Larry, at the same time.
You were the head of one of the first big city innovation offices in the city of Boston, and your boss, Tom Menino, longtime mayor of Boston, said that, well, what a lonely place it would be for a new idea. It would die here without any accompaniment. So tell us, what was an office of innovation, the type that you ran? What was that like? What were you expected to be thinking about? What kind of big thoughts?
Two great public servants, Chris Osgood and Nigel Jacob, ran the office. The three of us started it together, and I named it the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics because the mayor had been called the urban mechanic, and I certainly wanted the office to feel like it was of him. And particularly your question, Larry, about what does an office like that do? Because he had met more than half the people who lived in Boston. It was a remarkable figure for a mayor.
He had met half of the people?
Personally, yes, because he's so – even people who weren't from Boston, Larry, I don't know if you ever wandered through and shook his hand. But he believed deeply that you had to talk to members of the public to understand their problems, and also they might hold solutions to their problems. And so we named the mayor's Office of New Mechanics after him so he would like it, but also so that it would be imbued with that sense that if we're going to try innovation in the public sector, it's going to have to start with people and the problems they face and the solutions they have in their own mind. And that's not, frankly, where oftentimes a lot of innovation starts. It starts from a textbook, or it starts from a technology, or it starts from, you know, sort of good intentions. But oftentimes where it should start is with people and the problems they face. So he was adamant about that, and we were too. So that's the first rule of structuring an office like that. Work on the problems that face people in their daily lives. In addition, an office like that needs some permission to try new things that won't work. We actually went to the Boston Globe, the big newspaper in Boston, obviously, and said, hey, look, we're starting this innovation office. It's going to try a bunch of new things. Many of them are not going to work. We're not going to spend a lot of money on it. We're not going to spend a lot of time doing things that don't work. But you should look out here. You'll see some stuff. And you know what? I don't remember a single gotcha article that we got about what went wrong there, because we were transparent about the fact that it would. So I think the second rule of these things is that you have to communicate about them to the public and to the press. Nigel had called this office sort of the city's quote-unquote failure aggregator. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. It was a place where it was safe to try things and that wouldn't work. People were confident in the city that at the same time, you know, in other parts of the city apparatus, we're going to get the trash picked up, we're going to get the streets cleaned, we're going to improve the way we teach our students, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, we're told that our system of government is a great one for what you're talking about because we have all these laboratories. Now, some would say that a lot of this innovation should take place at the state level. You're talking about the city level. I remember doing an interview with the mayor of Oklahoma City, who wrote a book about how the real innovation that's going on in America, in his mind, is going on in mid-sized cities in America. So we have all these laboratories. What happens once it happens and it gets widely communicated to some extent through various journals and the like? Do people begin to pick up on that? Is that the way that a lot of innovation can take place?
I think it is. I think it sounds like Mayor Cornett was quite wise. I think start at these at the city level, small cities, medium-sized cities, large cities, states, even at the federal level. You can run experiments in order to solve public problems anymore. And when they work, when they succeed, people will pick them up and spread them. There's nothing like a success to encourage other public agencies and other public administrations to take up these new ideas. And goodness knows, by the way, that we could spread ideas that are working much more. There are ways we know today to solve problems of affordable housing, to solve problems of crumbling infrastructure, to improve what's going on around public health, to reduce inequity. There are ways to do that. And by all means, if you know of those and can deploy those in your city, state, and your federal agency, you should do that. But one of the arguments I make in the book is that we also don't have the solutions to a lot of those problems yet. If you really asked, have we come up with a way to make housing affordable in major cities? It's hard to say that we have. If you really asked yet, have we figured out a way to keep people healthy from pandemics, you would absolutely say no. So I do think we need to spread the ideas that are successful, but I think we need a re-emphasis and a return to coming up with solutions for the problems that face us today where we've not yet actually solved them.
But when you say that, you think about all the think tanks in America. They can be on the liberal side of things, the more moderately liberal, the very liberal, libertarian. I mean, there are tons of papers and lots of research that has gone on as it relates to public policy. You would think that if you took all of that good thinking, like we develop so many commissions and we come together and then we come out with solutions that hopefully can be implemented. Now, many of us might think it's not the ideas, it's that there are influence peddlers who have a reason not to want to see these things come to light. Is that part of the problem too?
I don't want to denigrate all the good thinking and careful thinking and important thinking being done by people inside think tanks and policy advisor groups and the like, and we should have that. But there's a problem if we rely only on that kind of thinking. First of all, much of it hasn't been, you know, what Brian Stevenson might say, proximate to the people facing these problems. I believe that if we're going to solve problems, we have to get much closer to the people that face them, that we're not going to solve them from the, you know, from our offices and writing our policy papers. We have to get onto the street. We have to get with the people who face these problems. We have to get into their homes. In the book, I write about a gentleman named Jimmy Chen who was trying to work on making food stamps work better. And he spends time in the living rooms of mothers on food stamps. I hazard to say that I think most people at think tanks haven't spent time waiting in line for food stamps or sitting in the living rooms of mothers who have done so. So I think that we need to do more of that getting proximate. I think that one of the other issues of sort of the slow roll of the policy paper and the commissions is that by the time we have the quote-unquote solutions to the problem, by the time that solution is delivered, after the commissions, after the papers, after the requests for proposals, right, after the 3 or 4 year deployment scheme, the problems have changed. Our world is moving too fast. And so we deliver a solution to a problem that isn't the same as when we started. And so one of the arguments I'm making is that we need to get faster at problem solving. And absolutely, I welcome all the ideas that are out there, but we need a new way to get closer to people, get closer to the problems, and then deliver solutions faster.
Philip K. Howard, you may know him. He heads a group called Common Good. And I've had him on the podcast in the past, and he talks about the red tape and the regulation, and the fact that we don't give those in the bureaucracy, first of all, they have been maligned for so many years, starting with the Reagan years and the last 40 years. They're not venerated in the way that they are in many other countries. Dr. Fauci would be a national symbol that we would all venerate in other cultures. But he was suggesting that we need to give those individuals who do understand the problems and are working with them on a client basis some freedom, some flexibility in the way that they go about their jobs as opposed to tying their hands. Do you agree with that? And do you think there's anything in the pandemic, for example, licensure changes, when somebody can finally cross a line from Connecticut over to New York and practice, which would not have been allowed if the exigencies of this crisis had not existed?
I agree that we need to give more freedom to people working in public office at all levels, state, city, federal levels, that we have over the years more and more proscribed, circumscribed what those public officials can do, and that has hampered our ability to solve new problems. There's also this other thing that's chilling them, and in the book I call it hot stove government. It's a riff on a concept from Jim March and Jerker Denrell, two scholars who were riffing in turn on Mark Twain. Right, Mark Twain had written about the cat who jumps on a hot stove and will get burned and learn never to jump on a hot stove again, but the cat will also learn never to jump on a cold stove either. So it's basically overlearning from failure. And I argue that we have hot stove government, Larry, that basically everywhere the burners have been turned up to scalding, and people inside government are afraid to try new things. Now, we want, by the way, we want accountability. Like, there's a reason why those burners should be hot. We don't want people in government trying things in foolhardy fashions. I mean, we saw We saw much of that in COVID. We certainly saw, you know, we shouldn't be swallowing Lysol. That's not a suggestion government officials should be able to make. We shouldn't be pursuing hydroxychloroquine. That's not a suggestion we want public officials making. So I'm not suggesting there should be no accountability for suggesting or trying new things. But on balance, overall, we need a strategy for allowing our public workers to be able to participate more with their ingenuity. I do think we need that.
Mitchell Weiss is our guest. We the possibility. What about Operation Warp Speed? What does that teach us, if anything? I was listening to a medical professional the other day saying that 70% of the research involved in that project had been taking place since Zika and Ebola, that we've really been at this for a long time, that it wasn't quite as warp speed as we say. But did that give us any idea that government could move more quickly on a problem?
I think there are absolutely ideas to draw from the work on the vaccine and wonder why we're not having as much success with vaccination. So let's start at the beginning. So think about all the potential ideas that were surfaced at all the various pharmaceutical companies about how we create a vaccine. At that moment, most of them were destined to fail. But tons of effort and energy were poured into making sure that a few succeeded. We should take that approach into government more often, which is when it comes to solving big problems, we should understand that there's going to be some failure along the way, but it's going to be required to accomplish the big solutions. Getting a vaccine, even as quick as we did, is a huge victory. And we have to recognize that it came with risk. And I think that's an attitude that we should take into other work in government. On the vaccination itself, obviously it's going woefully slow at this minute. Why? Well, in part, of course, it's a massive undertaking. And let's not take away any credit or momentum from the people who are working so hard, the public servants, to try to get that done. But you can imagine a way of going about this that might have prepared us better for this moment. We knew there was going to be a vaccine. Why, for example, in the book I write about how we could find ways to try things in minimally risky ways, just sort of prototypes for programs. Couldn't we have tried delivering flu vaccine in the ways we thought we would deliver COVID vaccine and learned about the faulty algorithms or the faulty prioritization in a less risky fashion? Couldn't some hospital have said, let's use the same protocol we think we're going to use for COVID vaccine for flu in November? And wouldn't they have identified, oh, we had the list of names wrong. We didn't have the lines outside set up correctly. I think one of the lessons to draw from this is that we can actually find ways to experiment on the things we want to do that without waiting till the risk is at its highest possible moment.
It's interesting. You talk about needing new ideas. We're short of fresh thinking, and we're limited by the resources at hand. And that's a really interesting point, because right now, say in the American structure, we are in such a debt situation because of the pandemic and because of the way the government has operated for so many years. So here we are, we've gotten ourselves flush in debt, and yet we haven't solved many of the problems that are going to need a lot more money to be solved, whether it's infrastructure, issues of income inequality, whether it's a universal basic income. Some of these bold ideas, or the Clean New Deal, you think about all of that, and Green New Deal, I should say, and you think about all of that, and you say, if we haven't solved the problems and we're in this much debt, how do we begin to not think about all the resource limitations that are facing us? I know I did a podcast with an economist who really espouses the modern monetary theory, where basically we just print the money we need and not worry about debt, because right now that's what we're doing, whether we want to acknowledge that or not.
My own view, Larry, is that possibility government would be a cheaper way to solve the problems that face us than what we do now. Even though I'm talking about, yes, we should try riskier projects, I'm saying we should actually try them in ways that minimize the amount of wasted time and the amount, to your point, of wasted treasure. So right now, in too many instances, yes, government is spending a lot of money on things, but it's actually spending money in ways that aren't actually solving the problem. And so certainly we're under resource constraints, but I would venture to say that if we go after novel solutions and we promise ourselves and the public to try them in more efficient ways, that we can do that even with the resource constraints that we face. it does take a bit of a perspective shift. I mean, most of the time, what we do as public officials, as good public officials, is we look around us at the resources that we have, at the budgets we've been given, at the people who are there, at the programs we're running, and we ask ourselves, you know, when the budget time comes around, how do we basically deliver these in the most efficient way possible? And that's a good question. That's a responsible question to ask ourselves. But I guess that what I'm inviting everybody is to ask a different question, which is to look out around them at the problems in their community and then ask themselves, what are the solutions to those problems? And ask others, what are the potential solutions to those problems? And then go marshal the resources towards them. And what it may end up meaning is that we spend money on vastly different things in vastly different ways, but that we ultimately solve the problems that face us.
How frustrated are you going to get when it's going to be so hard in a society like ours with so many jurisdictions? You've got so many towns. I live in the state of Connecticut, and we are 169 little fiefdoms, and barely do we want to have planning agencies that encompass 15 or more communities that provide anything other than guidance. We really don't want instruction coming from a regional source. And yet you look at our problems, and they're on the macro level, they're on the micro level. As you say, it was easier for the founders to start something out of nothing. Now that we have something, we find it very difficult. Through inertia, we just kind of hang on to the programs that we've had for so many years. What was the last really innovative program, as you look at it, that really encompassed all that you're talking about in terms of we the possibility?
Well, I'm not actually that frustrated. I mean, I'm sad these days, given the state of our country. I worry about the state of our democracy, but I'm actually optimistic. I have hope that I see in all those individual agencies and all those little towns, I see that people are resilient. I see that they have spent the last year, their public servants and people in that community, working as hard as they possibly can to rescue people from the virus, to rescue people from the economic havoc that it's wreaked. So I'm optimistic. I think there is a way to actually turn this all around. I've seen examples all around the world, episodes of public entrepreneurship. I mean, I see I get my optimism from somebody like the mayor of St. Paul, Minneapolis, Melvin Carter, who came into office promising to try to bring about equity for his rising unequally city, who had a large agenda, for example, for trying to develop what he called community-first public safety that would really start with and in the community. I see how that gets, how COVID, how the murder of George Floyd next door makes that difficult, and I see him pursue the innovations anyways. So I'm optimistic that there are public leaders like Melvin Carter and the people in his community all over this country and, frankly, all over the world. I think it's a matter of making sure that instead of, you know, continuing to turn on each other, we find a way to help people turn towards possibility instead.
When Michael Bloomberg was the mayor of New York City, I remember the bullpen that he set up for all kinds of ideas where he was in the middle of all of that, but he was not walled off in his office. He wanted to hear all the thinking, and they might be great ideas, they might be terrible ideas. One of the questions really is that a lot of people gave him a lot of credit for bringing innovation to New York City and the mayor's office. And then, of course, after, well, in this case, I think it was 12 years. He stayed on, I think, a term longer than is normal in New York City. You have a Bill de Blasio come in, and some people think he's done a modest job. But we have so much discontinuity in our government. So somebody comes in and changes a lot of the things that might have been innovative at one time and were still working, but for the sake of change, they make that change. So what do we do when we think about the discontinuity in our government?
I think that that's a real concern, and certainly if you talk to people in government, as you have and I have, about making change, that rises up on their list of worries. I think it's, frankly, I think it's overstated. Certainly there's change at the top, certainly at the city and state level and federal levels. We have changes at the top in terms of, you know, executive leadership. But, of course, in America, if you ask me, on balance, I think we have too much incumbency and not too little. And most of the people in government are there for quite a long time, both outside, in executive, agencies, if you will, and also in legislative branches. And so, while the people in the mayor's offices and governor's offices change, many of the people don't. I actually don't think that's the reason why we don't try novel solutions enough and why we don't scale them when they work. I think actually when things are truly, truly working, that public leaders are hard, most public leaders, I mean, there are some exceptions, most public leaders are hard pressed to stop the things that are not working. And so I think the way we get continuity is we actually get these programs up and running, tested, working as quickly as we can, make them as responsive to the people and their problems, the real problems, as they can be. And then they build ownership and buy-in in the community, and they're hard to undo, and they're welcome to replicate.
What about the risk and reward in the public sector? If, in fact, I'm working in the public sector, and the best thing that I can do is continue to implement whatever programs are there and keep my head down and not make a lot of noise, is that what we want to do? And some would say, is there a stultification because of unions? Is there anything that holds back a lot of the ideas and the possibilities that you're recommending in the book?
I think we have to change that risk-reward formulation, Larry. I think that in many instances, when we look around, if we look around, we have to recognize that actually the status quo is the risky choice, that doing nothing in many instances is actually more dangerous than trying something. And if leaders in public office take that view, if the public itself take that view, then we can change the formulation. Doing nothing on pandemic preparation was obviously the riskier choice. Doing nothing or very little on racial inequity was obviously the riskier choice. We left people bereft without hope, without fairness. Doing nothing on all the other crises that face us, on infrastructure right now, will anybody be surprised when another bridge collapses? Will anybody be surprised when a building collapses? Doing nothing is often the riskier choice. And so I think we have to change the formulation from assuming that trying something new is the risky thing to realize that it may well be not. In addition, I would say that we have to help people when they're trying new things, not try them in risky ways. I mean, the other way you change the formula is you make sure that doing new things isn't actually that risky. And there are methods in the book for trying new things in public life, in public spaces, that make them less risky than they might otherwise seem.
You quote in the book Jack Welch, "If the rate of change on the outside exceeds the rate of change on the inside, the end is near." And that's what we often hear, that things are moving at such a breakneck speed as it relates to technology on the outside and the way that we're interacting with so many different companies and corporations, the new delivery economy, the new remote working economy, and yet government seems to be the last one to change or even to understand that technology, as we've seen in many of these committee hearings when one of these technology giants comes before congressmen and they don't really even understand what he or she is talking about. So technology in all of this, what does government need to do? Because I know that some of the systems that we've had in our state government, where I used to work many years ago, are so outdated and outmoded.
I think it's a question of what we need to do both in government and in the private sector so that we both understand each other's business better. I would argue that those hearings, that people saw what they wanted to see, maybe you're referencing the sort of the original Orrin Hatch, Mark Zuckerberg hearing and the ones that have happened subsequent, where Senator Hatch asks, you know, Zuckerberg how they make money, you know, if they don't charge. And I think what you see advertising. And what you see in what you see in that response, I think, is a real Rorschach test, if you will, which is what many technologists saw was what you just expressed, Larry, which is, oh, my gosh, government doesn't understand what's going on in the technology world. But what many people in the policy world also saw was what Mark Zuckerberg didn't understand, which was, who does he think he is stepping into the civic square, into the public square, without spending enough time deeply understanding what the consequences of that might be. And that's where we find ourselves now. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on both sides about technology, but also about government. And I think people on both sides need to learn more about the other and come together. I think that there is a way in government to to learn more about what is happening on the outside of the world, which is certainly to invite in some of the outsiders, some of the people who have experience in user interfaces, have experience as software engineers, have experience as data visualization experts, have experience building some of those services and products in the technology world, and inviting those people into government, maybe not full-time, but for part-time. There's a pernicious version of that. It can become the old revolving door. You know, people worry that it used to be Goldman Sachs in and out of the Treasury, and today it's going to be Google in and out of technology and government, and that's a concern. But I do think that government at many levels can invite in outsiders with those skills and those talents, especially a young generation, Larry. We can say to people right today who are at home wondering, oh, my gosh, what do we do about our democracy, who are doom-scrolling Twitter, worrying about a democracy, which they should be, we can say to them, look, you can come into government and help. You want to shore up democracy? Come and work in government and help. But then we can also say to them, do it with humility. Don't assume that you bring all the answers in from the private sector. Don't assume that the way things work at your startup is just the way they work in government. It's different. We're serving public needs with public constituencies with complex problems. We can, if we come together, I think, bridge this divide, and there's understanding to be had on both sides.
Does the federal government have to provide at least the overarching concept of go big, let's think anew? Because my whole generation, and I'm a little bit older today, certainly older than you are, was inspired by JFK. And JFK said, we're going to go to the moon. And he didn't say, we're going to lose people in the process. No, we're going to build better science over the next 10 years that will safely get us to that point. And that was a risk. I mean, a tremendous risk to suggest that. So the question is, does the inspiration, because I know Joe Biden in his early days has been talking about going big in the first period of his presidency, does he set the tone, and does that excite what goes on not only in the federal government but in the state and local governments and just in people thinking about a career in public service?
I think he can set the tone. There's no question that the president of the United States has an influence on how people think about their government and whether they want to go into it and help. He said on Victory Night, you know, the night that Saturday he waited his whole adult life for, there's one word you can use to define America, and that word is possibilities. So what's he mean when he says possibilities? Certainly he means the future. Certainly he means change. Maybe he means big, as you say. I think what he's describing is an uncertain future. I sort of joke that if he wasn't talking about the uncertain future, he would have said probabilities. But he said possibilities, and I think very intentionally. Because America has always been, in some ways, our future has always been bright but uncertain. You can go back and look at our founders. You know, four of the first five founders in their inaugural addresses called this an experiment. An experiment. And it is. And it still is. And I think that that if President Biden can, yes, set the tone if he continues to hearken on that, continues to tap into some of that rhetoric about possibility. And at the same time, what you're expressing is, yes, a sort of bigness, but also a humility, which is that none of this is guaranteed. And it is going to take all of us. And not all of it's going to work. I think that's the honest way to talk about the future, is to talk about it as he has started to, as possibility. I think at the same time, if he does that, he will be tapping into already inspiration at the state and local levels. I know for a fact they've talked about this publicly, that they are drawing on inspiration they have seen from state leaders. There's no coincidence why they've drawn city leaders into their cabinet, for example. So there's inspiration to be found everywhere. And I think that if Americans want to, certainly they need to, if they want to look to for inspiration about how to make our country work better, about how to solve problems anymore, they can look to people talking about possibility everywhere.
We the possibility, harnessing public entrepreneurship to solve our most urgent problems. Mitchell Weiss, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure, Larry.